little bit of background as we take a look at this. What we're doing is we're going through the entire Bible about a book at a time. And so it's a pretty fast clip, as you guys have noticed. And the reason that we're doing that is just basically to build a framework to hang all of the details upon. And so this gives us an overview, or the Bible from 30,000 feet, if you will, looking down at what the whole thing says, so that as we're reading through it, we kind of have this overview that we can put it all on. So it's not like we're rushing to get through the Bible before the Lord returns, you know, or anything. But that's the point of why we're doing what we're doing. So as we come to the book of Esther, we've made our way through the history in the Old Testament as God chose chose Abraham, brought him into the promised land, and then his descendants went down into Egypt. They were slaves under Moses. They came out under Joshua. They came in to the promised land. They were ruled by judges for a period of time, and then they began to be ruled by kings for a period of time. Both the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, which was all of the tribes of Israel, there was just civil war and they became divided for much of their history. Both of them went into captivity, the northern kingdom by the Assyrians, 722 BC, the southern kingdom by the Babylonians in roughly 586 BC. What we've done is we've come to the time period where Israel, about after 70 years, has come back into the land, and they're rebuilding the temple, and Persia is in power at this time, and the children of Israel have come back in, and they will remain in that land as the Greeks come into power, the Romans come into the power, and then we come into the New Testament, where we read of Jesus, of his life and ministry. So as we come to the book of Esther, this is a story of a Jewish girl who became queen of Persia and saves her people, the Jewish people, from annihilation by an evil man named Haman. The Feast of Purim commemorates this deliverance. And Purim this coming year is going to be, I think it's the last weekend of March. And so when you hear of the Feast of Purim, something they still celebrate to this day, they're celebrating this deliverance that took place that we're going to be reading about here this morning. They celebrate with great feasting, exchanging gifts, and reading the book of Esther. This is a story of God's hand of protection over his chosen people. We can see that as we go through there. His sovereign hand is upon them, protecting them, leading them. However, God's name is never mentioned in this book. So not his personal name, not even the word God is mentioned in this book anywhere. Add to that, Esther, the book of Esther, is not quoted in the New Testament. It's the one book that was not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yet, it has been widely received as inspired scripture throughout Jewish and Christian history. So that's kind of an interesting element to the book of Esther. What might be considered chance is clearly seen as the sovereign providential hand of God in delivering his chosen people from annihilation. Esther is one of the three, they call them the post-exile books. In other words, after the children of Israel came back from Babylon, there were three books written: Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. Roughly after 70 years of captivity, as we read in the book of Ezra, Zerubbabel returned with about 50,000 people and began to build the temple, were shut down for about 20 years, but then came back and were able to complete the temple. Go forward from that time period about 50 years, and you've come to the book of Esther. So this is roughly, excuse me, the time period for Esther. Then go forward about 12 or 20 years, I think it is, and you come to the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. So in the book of Ezra, we're reading in the beginning about Zerubbabel bringing 50,000 initially back to start rebuilding the temple and completing it. Then you go forward and you've got the book of Esther, and then you go forward a little bit more and you have Ezra coming, trying to rebuild the spiritual state of the people to get their hearts turned back to the Lord. And then go forward about a decade more and you've got Nehemiah coming back, who's trying to rebuild the walls, the defenses of Jerusalem. So that's where this book sets within the timeline. So if you open the book of Ezra you would take the book of Esther and put it right in the middle of that, okay? The beginning of Ezra is going to be Zerubbabel, then you have Esther, and then you have Ezra actually coming on the scene after that, and then we come into the book of Nehemiah. So that would be, in a chronological way, how we would put that together. So in this story, a prince of Persia wants to annihilate the Jews. It's interesting to notice how Persia would be modern day what?
Iran.
Be modern day Iran. It's interesting to see how nothing has really changed. The Iranians want to wipe the Jews off of the map. And that's what we see in this book as well from a prince of Persia named Haman. Esther's an old story with modern relevance. But just as God intervened back here in the book of Esther, so I believe God's going to intervene as well. Why do I believe that? One of the reasons is when we look at Ezekiel 38 and 39, the Battle of Gog and Magog, where you do have Russia and Iran and Northern Africa coming against Israel. As you read through that, it's not Israel and their mighty military might that fights them off. It's God who is able to take them and fight for his people. Yeah, it sounds like it's doing what it was, huh? Interesting. Well, now we know there is something wrong with it. Okay, so the story begins with the great feast in chapter 1. We're introduced to King Ahasuerus and Queen Vashti. So let's jump right into chapter 1, verse 1 of the book of Esther. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And so I have in my notes that Ahasuerus is the Xerxes of history. And this, what we're reading about right here, corresponds to the great feast of Xerxes that he gave when he was planning to invade Greece. He had his leaders gathered to plan the invasion, and at the same time, he showed off his riches, including his wife, as we'll see shortly. So 180 days, you know, half of a year that basically this is getting set up, and then this final period where the feast is taking place. And then he summons his wife to come, as we're going to jump around now and jump ahead to verse 10, where it says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, these are the eunuchs, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious and his anger burned within him. So I guess you just imagine a drunken feast and they're all partying down. He's like, hey, check out my babe, you know, and wants to bring his queen, who, as it says, was very beautiful to behold. But she's like, ain't no way that I'm going in there. And so this is what gets him so upset. And so then the challenge is, what are we going to do about Queen Vashti? Because the guys that are there are saying, she's setting the standard here. If she's not going to obey you, then our wives aren't going to obey us. So you need to do something to punish her. And that's where this whole thing takes place. And so they want her to be dethroned. And so to replace her, they hold a beauty contest. And this is where Esther fits in. So Esther is Jewish. Esther is the Persian name, Hadassah is the Hebrew name. So she's over there because, remember again, the Jews had been taken into captivity and many of them grew up, that's where their lives were over in Babylon that was then conquered by the Medes and the Persians. And only 50,000 or so went back into the Promised Land. And many of them stayed over there and grew up. And so this is where Mordecai and his cousin Hadassah is. And we're going to read about that, where Mordecai takes Hadassah under his wing because her parents have passed away. And so we're introduced to Esther and Mordecai here in chapter 2. We're just going to go ahead and jump ahead to verse 5, where we see Esther taken to be brought in as one of the candidates to become queen. Verse 5 of chapter 2, in Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Hegai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And so, as we see here, Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin, same as Israel's first king, King Saul. And his brother's daughter, I guess is what it's saying, is Hadassah. Hadassah, the Hebrew name, it means myrtle. Esther, the Persian name, it means star. And Esther finds favor in the eyes of the eunuch of the harem. But Mordecai had instructed Esther not to let them know that she was a Jew. So this is all behind the scenes, if you will. Now, she ends up becoming queen, verse 17 of chapter 2. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So that's what sets the stage in getting Esther to this place, this position, if you will, within the king's favor as the new queen. Now, there's something that happens at the end of chapter 2 that's kind of crucial to the story. It sets the stage for what's going to take place later. And this is where Mordecai, again, he's brought up this girl as his own daughter, basically. And now she's been taken and she becomes queen, but he still has a heart for her. So he wants to look out for her. So he ends up hanging out at the king's gate where others would be hanging out to hear how is Hadassah doing? Is everything going okay in there? And so forth. And as he's hanging out at the king's gate, he discovers there's a plot to take out the king. And that's what we read about beginning from verse 21 in chapter 2. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, 2 of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Just a little bit of information there, which will come into play later as we make our way through. So as we come into chapter 3, we're introduced to Haman. He's the villain in the story. And we read here how, again, Mordecai is at the gate. Haman is an important person that is with the king. But Mordecai will not acknowledge Haman. He won't bow down to him, won't show him any kind of respect, if you will. So in chapter 3, beginning from verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Real quick, why do you think he won't bow down to him?
Yeah, he has his own God.
That's right, right. It's like the three Hebrew children that were thrown in the fiery furnace. They're not going to bow down to a golden image because they're only going to bow down to the Lord. And you're right. It's but even though it doesn't mention, and that's the other thing, doesn't mention God in this book, but that's kind of what's inferred, isn't it? He's a Jew. He's not going to bow down to this pagan. Verse 3, then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So Mordecai's refusal to bow to Haman leads to Haman wanting to annihilate not just Mordecai, but Mordecai's people as well, the Jews. Now, one thing that is somewhat maybe speculation, but interesting to note is back in verse 1 of chapter 3, Haman is referred to as an Agagite. Now, some would understand this, that Haman is from a Persian province called Agag. Others understand this, that Haman is a descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Do you remember that? Oh. So that was in the days when Samuel told King Saul, you need to go and utterly wipe out the Amalekites. And Saul goes and he kind of wipes them out, but then he takes the flocks as spoil, and he takes the king, King Agag, as a trophy. And so he doesn't utterly wipe them out. And with the Amalekites, I mean, why would God say to do that anyway? They were perennial enemies of Israel. When Moses was leading the children of Israel out of the promised land and they're in the wilderness, it's the Amalekites that are coming and they're attacking the people in the rear, the scragglers, the old people that can't keep up, like you and me. You know, we're trying to keep up with the rest of the nation, and here come the Amalekites. We're gonna wipe out the people who can't really fight for themselves. And then, by the way, that's the passage where Joshua goes down and fights. Moses is up on the hill, and as long as Moses has the rod of God in his hand lifted up, Joshua and Israel are winning. But when his hands get tired and the rod goes down, then the Amalekites start winning, and that's where Aaron and Hur come and hold up Moses' arms until Joshua gets the victory. Jehovah Nissi, the Lord is our banner. We fight under him. He's the one who's leading us. And so years later then, God directs Samuel to order Saul to wipe out the Amalekites. But Saul doesn't do that, and that's where we have the passage, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. This is the shift with Saul at this point, where the kingdom is going to be taken from him and given to a man that's after God's own heart, which would be David, King David. What's interesting to take note of back then in that story, Saul would not utterly wipe out the Amalekites. It was an Amalekite that claimed to kill Saul in 2 Samuel chapter 1 when he was bringing news to David. And so here, as we move forward, if in fact Haman is a descendant of this group of people, then here you have those that should have been taken care of, that weren't taken care of, now coming back to annihilate the people of God. And the principle that's drawn from that is when God shows us to annihilate something, not someone, but something in our life, a vice, a sin, whatever it might be, and we don't do it, it can come back and destroy us. And so that's why we want to be obedient to God's word and follow through on that and not entertain that. So that's kind of a principle that we see there. So this decree is given then to annihilate the Jewish people in chapter 3. Verse 7, notice in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So the casting of lots, or the whatever it is, the drawing of straws, the throwing the dice. Let's figure out when we're going to do this. I think this is significant. And again, I think you kind of see the providential hand of God in this. This is the first month of Nisan. It would be our January. They cast lots, and it falls on the 12th month of Adar, which would be our December. So what does it do? It gives them nearly a year to prepare for this annihilation of the Jews, rather than, oh, it's going to be this month, next week. We're going to have about 12 months that we can figure out what we're going to do once this decree is given. Notice that it says they cast pur, and then they define what pur means. They cast lots. And this is where the name Purim comes from, when we have the Feast of Purim. So the word itself just means lots, the casting of lots, here to determine when they were going to do this.
Where are you at, Steve?
I am in chapter 3, verse 7. Let me throw this out to you when I talk about the providential hand of God. Proverbs 16:33 says, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's like what we would look at as chance is in reality God's providential hand of his will being accomplished. This will give plenty of time to counter Haman's attack. So the writers are going to go out now and let everybody know of the decree that's living in the 127 provinces, as well as Shushan, the capital. And it's going to be, guess what? On this day in Adar, we're going to completely exterminate the Jewish people, and you can go ahead and take their spoils once you do that. So you can imagine what it did to the people, that the riders go out kind of like the Pony Express of old to give word to the provinces. And as we look at the very last verse of chapter 3, verse 15, it says, the couriers went out and hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. And you can imagine, this decree goes out, let's completely wipe out this race right here. They go and have a brewski and kick back, you know, and business as usual. But the people are confused. It's like, why are we doing this? And maybe not just that. Maybe we're next. You know, maybe it's the Jews now, and maybe we're the next people. So it created, obviously, this confusion that took place. And Mordecai, you can imagine, I mean, this all came because of him and his unwillingness to bow down to Haman. Right. And so he's now donning sackcloth and ashes. It's the signs of mourning, really, and fasting and what? And prayer, and which is seeking after God, is really, again, the idea behind it, though that's not mentioned. Again, God's not mentioned in it, but that seems to be what's implied by all of this. And so he's at the gate now, donning sackcloth and ashes, and somebody sees him and lets Esther know. And this begins this conversation between Esther and Mordecai through a servant that's going back and forth, and they're speaking to one another. So in chapter 4, verse 1, it says, when Mordecai learned all that happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and a bitter cry. Word gets back to Esther. Esther inquires, and Mordecai directs Esther to go to the king to plead for her people. Remember, at this point, nobody knows that Esther is Jewish. So now Mordecai says, you need to go before the king because she's the queen. Go before the king and say, hey, look, my people are destined to be wiped out, which would include me. And so we jump to verse 10 of chapter 4. It says that Esther spoke to Hathach. So this is the guy, the go-between between her and Mordecai, and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. So Esther's response when Mordecai is saying, hey, go to the king, she's like, this is the law. Nobody can go to the king unless he calls. He'll be put to death unless he holds forth the golden scepter when you come in. So she sends word back to Mordecai, verse 13. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." So herein is Mordecai's words. Don't think you're going to escape just because you live in the king's palace. You're Jewish too. This decree has gone out. And this is one thing that we have to realize under the laws of the Medes and the Persians. When a law was set forth, the king could not change that law. Okay? When that law was set forth, he himself had to abide by it. Think about when the law went forth that nobody could pray to anybody else except the king in the book of Daniel. And when Daniel begins to pray, he's broken that law and nobody could pray to any other god but the king. And when Daniel broke that law, the king couldn't go, because the king liked Daniel, the king couldn't go, "No, I don't want you to go into the lion's den." He couldn't change it because that was according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians. So he was thrown into the lion's den, and of course, God spared his life in the lion's den. So this is the same kind of thing. A decree has been made so the people can attack the Jewish people. You can't change that. And so what Mordecai wants Esther to do is go in and plead, and what we're going to see happen is another law is going to come in to where the Jews have the legal right to defend themselves and be able to fight back. And that's really how that is going to be worked out. But Esther's saying, "I can't. I can't go in there because he's going to kill me." And Mordecai's saying, "Look, you're going to die anyway, you know. And if you fail to go in, there is going to be someone who's raised up." Again, it doesn't say God's name, but it's like his will is going to be accomplished from another quarter to go in and be able to help out the Jewish people. But I love this. Who knows if God has positioned you for such a time as this? And this is where I want to take that and bring it to us personally. You know, we're given certain opportunities in our lives. And who's to say that God hasn't put us in the day that we live right now, in the place that we live right now, with the people that we know right now, for this particular time to be used as his spokesman? And that could be in a number of different ways. It could be us just encouraging one another as brothers in the Lord, you know, to come alongside somebody, to make that phone call to encourage that other person, or to be there to share the truth of the gospel with our friends, with our family members, within our community. And we get certain opportunities, don't we, that come along. And those opportunities, when they come, if we don't act upon them, they pass by. But who knows if we haven't been placed in a particular position at a particular time for such a time as this. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 and 16 says, "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil." See that you walk carefully. See that you walk in wisdom, redeeming the time. And that in the NIV is making the most of every opportunity. So when somebody or something arises, to simply pray and say, "God, is this an open door? Is this the opportunity you want me to take to share in this moment?" And just always being aware of the day that we live in, that any time can be an opportunity to be used by him. So that's kind of a key thing. That's the one thing that stuck out to me through this whole book to share with all of us. We live in interesting times, and we have the opportunity. Again, I don't want to just take it. This is the most important in sharing the gospel, but I don't want to just take it to that for one another. I mean, there's times where we're going through things where we need one another. We need those words of encouragement and people to come alongside. And you know how it is when it's laid on your heart to call somebody up or to come alongside them. Take a moment and see how they're doing. When we let that go by, I think we're missing an opportunity, because I believe it could be the Lord laying that on our heart. And then, of course, sharing the gospel, having the opportunity to do that. And I totally get it. Nobody wants to be rejected. You know, you don't want to share the gospel and have people reject you and so forth. But there's going to be that person who's truly searching and seeking. And I think when God lays it on our hearts, he knows what's coming up. And so I think one of the best things to do is when you feel it on your heart, now maybe I should share with that person is to pray, to ask, Lord, are you leading here? Are you opening the door here for me to share you with them? And then usually, you know, after the first sentence or two, if the door's opening or slamming shut, but step out, because who knows whether God has risen you up to have an impact for such a time as this. That's from a personal standpoint. I can't help but look at the United States of America from a national standpoint. And I think about really what we're talking about right here, the annihilation of the Jewish people back in the days of Esther and the annihilation of the Jewish people today. Because what we see taking place over in the Middle East is not a desire for a two-state solution. What we see taking place and have seen taking place over in the Middle East is a desire to completely wipe the Jewish people off of the map. That's what the leader of Iran said not that many years ago, and it's very obvious. That's what Hamas wants to do, what Hezbollah wants to do. They don't want to live side by side with the Jewish people. They're the infidels. They want to get rid of them, and they want that. It's not even really a land thing. It's an ideology thing. They don't want them there. And so why are they not being annihilated right now? From a human standpoint, why are they not being annihilated? I can think of some aircraft carriers that are sitting over there right now that are keeping them from acting, and that's the United States. And I can't help but think of the United States being in a position for such a time as this to be a deterrent for those that want to wipe them out and also to assist them during this time period. And so I think that is key. And so I also think it's key for us as inhabitants of this country. Because I do firmly believe that God sovereignly chose Abraham and brought him into that land. And he reiterated the promise that he gave of the land, of the nation, of the Messiah to Isaac and also to Jacob and his descendants. And I also firmly believe, it's no secret that you guys know, that I believe God has a future plan for the nation of Israel. So when I go back to that calling in Genesis chapter 12, I think of when God said to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you. I can't help but think, this is personally, that God isn't blessing the United States of America because they are blessing the Jewish people, the nation of Israel right now at this point. So what are we supposed to do as inhabitants of this country? The main thing that we're directed to do is to pray for the leaders of our country. And I'll be honest with you, it is so easy, and I totally get it, to be critical of the leaders that are in power when they're not your party, right? So we're critical of them. But I think we ought to be really thankful for President Biden right now because he has made a decision to send and keep that aircraft carrier, at least for right now, over there, okay? So we should be thankful for that in what he's doing because we know he could easily just go, not my problem, and then it would be a whole different ballgame that's taking place over there. So we're directed to pray for kings and all who are in authority. Why? So that we could live quiet and peaceful lives. And we talked about this a little bit on Wednesday night when we talk about praying for the peace of Jerusalem. What does that mean? You know, what are we praying for? Well, I think ultimately we're praying for the return of Jesus because that's the only time where that they're fully going to have peace. But as I mentioned Wednesday night, it was very interesting that God said through Jeremiah the prophet to those who were taken to Babylon in captivity, said, go ahead and build houses. Go ahead and marry one another and pray for the peace of this land, for in its peace, you will have peace. You're going to be there for an entire generation. And so go ahead and settle down and pray for the leadership. And I think that's much the same thing. We want to live in peace. We don't want there to be civil war or chaos going on. And so that's why we're directed to pray for the leaders. Totally get it about being critical of them. But that's not what God's directed us to do. He's directed us not to criticize them, to make fun of them with one another, but to pray for them. And I can't help but think, well, I know, and I don't think I wrote it down. Yeah, I did. Proverbs 21:1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, like the rivers of water. He turns it wherever he wishes. You know, God is sovereign. He's also instructed us to pray. One other thing I want to point out that jumped out at me in this case, when Mordecai is saying to Esther, don't think you're going to escape. You're Jewish too. You know, this is going to affect you. And I think about this current hatred for the Jews over in the Middle East. It's over there. Don't think we're going to escape, because it's not just a hatred for the Jewish people. It's a hatred for the Christians as well. It's not just a hatred for Israel. It's a hatred for America as well. And so as we see the unrest, not just in Europe, but also here in the U.S., don't think that this is just something, it's their problem, we don't have to worry about it. This is something that's going to rise up and is rising up here as well. And I think this is one of the reasons that we need to be prepared, because if those things start happening here, you can imagine that the anxiety, the fear that's going to come in, even to the people of God. And this is where it's important that we are grounded in our faith, our trust in the Lord. And it's coming back and recognizing again, He is sovereign over all. He is the one who is in control. So it doesn't matter what might be rising up around us. He is the one that is in control. And the last thing I wanted to add to this is that underneath all of this is a spiritual battle, okay? This is satanic, what we see. The hatred of God's people, whether we're talking about the Jews or whether we're talking about Christians, it's satanic. The devil hates God. The devil hates God's people. And so there's going to be this attack that's going to take place. But don't forget, God is infinitely greater than the devil. Okay, not equal opposites. You have God, the creator of all, and you have the devil, a created being who knows his time is short. So this is what's underlying everything. So all the more why we should pray, because that's really where the battle is fought and where the battle is won, as we're praying for God's will and for God's perfect usage of us and others within this thing. And I'll be honest with you, my prayer for... And I pray that everyone's eyes would be open. That's really my prayer. For the Jewish people, it's almost all the more so. As it says in Romans 9, like to them was the covenants and the promises. And it's like, come on, you're the ones that God chose to initiate this thing. My prayer is that their eyes would be open, not that they would win a battle. You know, I want them to win the battle too, but I want their eyes to be open and recognize Jesus as their Messiah. But the Arabs, I feel the same way. I want their eyes to be open as well, that they would recognize Jesus as their Messiah, because in the end, that's all that's really going to matter, is if your life is right with God or not. And so that's my heart for them as we go forward and as we lift up our hearts in prayer. Let's see what Esther's response is to this. When Mordecai says, who's to say you haven't been raised up for this time or not? Notice her response in verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So she's willing to risk her life on behalf of her people, which is very admirable. And so chapter 5, we have Esther going before the king. Guess what? The golden scepter is extended. Esther invites the king and Haman to a banquet. And the king says, Esther, what do you want? Up to half the kingdom. She goes, well, I want you to come to a second banquet tomorrow. And I can't help but think that Esther's like, I don't know how to do this. You know, I don't know how to break this news. And so I'm going to have to kind of start paraphrasing a little bit here. But Haman was invited to this banquet. Just the king and Haman and Esther's there, but Esther doesn't want to bring up the topic yet. So she goes, I want you guys to come back tomorrow for a banquet. Haman leaves, but there's Mordecai sitting at the gate, and Haman is just infuriated that Mordecai will not pay him the respect that he feels that he's due. So he goes home and he tells his wife and those that are with him, and they say, you know what? Why don't we just build a gallows 75 feet high and we'll have Mordecai hung on that? And Haman's like, that sounds good. We're going to do that. So chapter 6, it just so happens that the king can't sleep that night. And so what do you do when you can't sleep?
Read a history book.
You read something boring. So he says, bring me the chronicles of what took place. This is where it factors in what we looked at in chapter 2. Remember? Where Mordecai was the one that discovered the plot against the king's life. And so this is being read to the king at this time. He says, well, what has been done for this Mordecai? He says, oh, nothing's been done for him. Oh, we got to do something to be able to honor this guy for what he's done in saving the life of the king. And so just about this time, Haman walks in to suggest that Mordecai be hung on the gallows that he just built. And so we're going to take it up in chapter 6, okay, beginning from verse 6. Esther 6:6. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. Oh, man, what do you say to that? Thus shall it be done. So Haman goes home in disgrace. And his wife said, ah, you're in for it now. You're going to fall. So as we come into chapter 7, it's the second banquet. And this is where Esther pleads for her life. So the king and Haman, chapter 7, went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day of the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is it your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Now, can you ever know it's like when it just your everything falls down into the pit of your stomach? Can you imagine what it was like for him at that period? And he had no idea that there was somebody in the ruling hierarchy that could thwart his plan. He had no idea that Esther was Jewish. And so the king goes out, you know, again, he is filled with rage. He goes out, probably, and this is my right-hand man. And he's called for the extermination of the Jews. And don't forget, the king can't change that. It's not like the king can go, Haman, you're fired. We're not going to do what you suggested to do. He knows they have to follow through with that. And his wife, the queen, is Jewish as well. So he's out in the garden, probably steaming and figuring out what to do. At the same time, Haman is pleading for his life before Esther and ends up like falling on his knees and over the couch on top of her as the king comes walking in. And so the king calls for the people. They take Haman out and they hang him on the gallows that he had built for Mordecai. It's, you've got that poetic justice coming around. And then as we make our way through, we see the king giving Mordecai the place of authority, the signet ring, and also eventually the household of Haman. And so what Haman thought was going to be his ultimate victory became his ultimate defeat, didn't it? And I can't help but think, again, the spiritual battle underneath, what Satan thought would be his ultimate victory in having Jesus crucified. Ah, we got him, the Son of God. Became his ultimate defeat, because this is where the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. Interesting to see the parallel. And so we see as we move into chapter 8, Mordecai is exalted. He's given the signet ring. Let's just read verses 1 and 2. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. So the problem, as I mentioned, still remains. The laws of the Medes and the Persians cannot be altered. So a new law needs to be made so that the Jews can defend themselves. And that's what's going to go out as a second law that will counter that first law. What came to my mind is in thinking of, on a bigger picture, the laws of God. God set forth his standards for all of us. We've all broken God's laws. We've all sinned. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. God doesn't rescind that, does he? God doesn't go, you know what? I know I made the law, but I'm just going to forgive you anyway. We'll just do away with that law. He doesn't do that because his law stands, because he is just. So what does he do? He creates a secondary way, and that's bringing his son into this world to pay the price that we owe, to bear the judgment for our sin so that we can be saved. Isn't that kind of neat? So it still shows the justice of God. That's the thing in the sacrifice of Jesus. That's why that was important. It shows the justice of God being served, being meted out through all of that. And just as Esther was willing to lay her life down for the salvation of her people, so Jesus laid his life down. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. And so, short order, they come up with a new decree, send out the decree that the Jews can defend themselves and fight for themselves against those who would attack them. And so the decree goes out. We come to the 12th month, and the Jews go out. They are successful. They win against those that would battle against them. And this is what develops then into this Feast of Purim. So we're going to jump ahead to chapter 9, beginning from verse 26, chapter 9, verse 26, where it says, so they called these days Purim after the name Pur. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants and all who had joined them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. And as I mentioned, it's the last weekend of March, I believe, the Feast of Purim this coming year. And it's something they continue to do to this day. And what are they doing? They're celebrating the victory that they had. They're celebrating the fact that they were spared. They were not annihilated, but they had the victory. What other Jewish feast just concluded here?
Hanukkah,
the Feast of Hanukkah. And what was Hanukkah?
Festival of Lights, the Maccabees.
The Festival of Lights. And actually, it mentions about Jesus in the time of the Festival of Lights. So prior to Jesus coming, where Antiochus Epiphanes went and desecrated the temple to where he offered a pig upon the altar. And so it desecrated it to where they could not have their sacrifices anymore. And it was the Maccabees that rose up and were able to conquer over Antiochus and cleanse the temple. And I think the story is they had enough oil for one lighting of the candelabra, and it miraculously lit for 8 days. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong on that, until they could make more. And so it was a celebration of the cleansing of the temple, but really a celebration of a victory over their enemies. So you see these feasts that the Jewish people have are feasts of victory because people want to wipe them out and how they were able to be successful. So just in wrapping this up, chapter 10, you can tell it's very small here. Mordecai is elevated, of course, Queen Esther. This, again, is all taking place when the Jews have come back shortly into their land, and this is taking place over in Persia during this time period. So it's kind of interesting to see that. What you see here, I think, is the sovereign, providential hand of God working behind the scenes, if you will, in orchestrating this deliverance, in Esther getting to this place of favor to where she can intercede on behalf of her people, to the time of when Pur was cast to be on the 12th month. And and so many things where God's hand is in that, and yet God is not mentioned at all. And that's the interesting thing about that. He's not mentioned at all in it. It's a book that's not quoted in the New Testament. It's a book that's not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's like a kind of like a head scratcher, yet it's been a book that's been received by the Jewish people and by the Christian people. And so that's kind of that's the story of the book of Esther. The last thing that I just want to leave us with is taking us back to opportunity. What opportunities has God given to us? What opportunities lay yet in front of us to be able to be used by him? We live in days that are challenging for us, and they could become really tumultuous days in the not too distant future. It's an opportunity for us to be solid and grounded in our faith so that we're not wavering when difficulties hit, but we're able to be strong and we're able to bring encouragement to the body of Christ and truth to those who are going to be equally disturbed and looking for some kind of sense of what's going on. I believe we've got a great insight into why there is evil in the world and why there is such chaos around us. And we've got also the knowledge of the solution that God has brought his son Jesus into this world so that we can have abundant life now and peace now and forever because of Jesus and what he's done for us.